For many years now, my friend Ram Bhakta has been editing my talks from various classes and sermons into articles, which he posts on the internet as Heart to Heart, is what it's called, for those of you who might enjoy it. They're transcribed, and then he does a wonderful job of editing. I recently looked at one, and it started with a joke that was so good that I had forgotten. That actually I think will relate somewhat to today. This is a joke about the oneness of all religion. And it starts with, it's a cartoon, and there are a couple of bears, and they're kind of sitting at a picnic table, probably in Yosemite somewhere, and they're chatting with each other. And they say, you know, Sikhs, Muslims, Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, they all taste like chicken. I thought of it also because those of you who follow these things, there's been this financial phenomenon that's happening with this company called Beyond Meat. And I happened to hear the founder, the chief chemist for that company, giving a talk on the radio when I was driving. And he was a man who had capabilities, and the details escape me, but at some point, he decided that climate change was a serious issue, and he wanted to do something to contribute. And apparently the growing of beef and meat and animals in the way it all works is a huge contributor to the problem of global warming. And so he decided he would dedicate himself to finding a real substitute for meat, not something that vegetarians like who have already repudiated meat, but something that meat eaters would eat that satisfied them. So, as it happened, this product has now, apparently the company's just going through the roof in terms of its stock, and this man was not talking about it from that point of view, but I'm sure he doesn't mind. But a friend of mine, a devotee from Ananda, was so pleased with this product, they brought a package for me to look at, and it was what's supposed to be hamburger. Now, I've been a vegetarian for 50 years, and actually not the last piece of animal flesh that I ever ate, but close to the last was a hamburger that I happened to have at a restaurant somewhere in this area. And that night, I dreamt all night long of this hamburger on the bun with the tomato and the pickle and the lettuce, and it was moving through my body like this, and everywhere it moved there would be this big bulging thing, and it was enough to pretty much settle the issue for me. So she brings me these hamburger patties. And the only word I can think of is they creeped me out. They look so much like hamburger, I gave them back to her. Then recently, some of my housemates actually had one, so I thought, okay. So I took a little bite, and I put it in my mouth. Immediately, it just tasted like hamburger. I actually had to spit it out. I mean, I think they've done a really good job. We had an acquaintance of ours who himself said that he's the most dedicated meat eater that there is. His nickname is some particular cut of steak, actually. And he was just telling us about this thing that they even put beets in it so it looks pink, like this. This is all what creeped me out. Okay, now let's get this back to where we're going. You know, in 66, when I was like not quite 20, I got caught up in the big... You know, I was a baby boomer, and I was one of the early adapters. Is that the word? Adopters, adapters. I never know what word it is. But I was one of the first in my group to drop out of college. You know, one of the first to go in the quest for God. I mean, I was way out there. One of the early vegetarians. When I converted my diet so completely, at that time we had a friend who worked for General Mills. He was an accountant for General Mills, actually, and at that time, I don't know if they still even exist, everything changes, but they made Cheerios and Wheaties and all those things. He said to us, honestly, he said, just tear up the box and put it in the bowl and pour milk on it. He says, it has more nutrition than what's inside the box. You know, so I'm starting on all of this, and we're just so radical, and in those days, you had to make everything. You had to make your own yogurt, you had to make your own bread, you had to make your own granola, ice cream, anything you wanted that was healthy. You had to start, you had to plant the plant and grow it and harvest it and then make it work. And when I really converted and became a vegetarian and all of this, one of my relatives was sure I was going to die before I was 25. So they required me to write out my entire diet, everything I ate, and we submitted it to the doctor, who said we would probably live to be about 150 and be the healthiest people he'd ever known, which at least silenced that concern. But we were so out there on either the cutting edge or the lunatic fringe, just depending. I preferred the lunatic fringe. I thought it was much more interesting than to be the other, but just experimenting with everything, which ultimately led me to walk away from it all and move to Ananda and never look back, which is me standing here now after all these years. And it just, it made sense to me, and I just went there. But very few people were with us on that journey. Very few people were with us on that journey. But now, Beyond Meat is one of the hottest new companies, you know, happening in the world today. Like, what happened? You know, what happened in all of this? Walmart swears, you know, now says that low-income people have a right to organic foods, so they're going to make sure there's organic foods. At least this is a rumor that I heard. I don't know if it's really true. But just everywhere you go, what used to be radical is now moving into the mainstream. Swamiji would often talk to us about how societies are transformed, and he emphasized, Swamiji was much more knowledgeable about history and people and everything. He was just a highly educated man, quite apart from his spiritual understanding. He was just well-read and well-versed in many aspects of the world. He'd been a king and a general and many things in other lifetimes, and he had this vast knowledge of how society works. He would often talk about world events in a tone of voice that I just never heard anyone else use. And this may not quite communicate, but I'll try. At some point when Israel went to war, one of the times they went to war, and they gained possession of the Golan Heights. Now, I've been to Israel now, and I understand, you know, Israel's a very small country, and that the Golan Heights, I believe, used to be in the hands of one of their enemies. Since everyone is their enemy, it doesn't matter. And they used to be able to shoot down at the people in Israel. And so when Israel got possession of that, that was a huge military victory because they had been tormented by that strategic advantage. But I remember Swami just commenting. He was commenting like king to king. Well, now that Israel has the Golan Heights, they must never give them up. You know, just like that. Like, this is how it works. This is how things move. And this is how kings and leaders make the world work. But Swamiji made this interesting comment that almost all major shifts in the direction of civilization have always been a small group of people working together who move outside of the mainstream and then begin to generate magnetism there, and gradually the mainstream moves into where they are. You know, whether it's Christianity or it's vegetarianism or it's organic foods, or it's whatever it might be. And he would talk to us about Ananda, about what we were doing for Master. And he was always very, he had this enormously long view of what was happening. We were all so impatient in the moment. You know, why aren't more people coming? Why aren't hundreds of people with us? And Swami was just, he was like a water on a stone. You know, we just persevere, and you look back in history, and you see how it happens. When Jesus died, no one would have ever thought anything was going to come of that. He was just this obscure rabbi who the power structure had managed to wipe out. You know, many of his disciples had already left him by that time, and many panicked at that point. There was a tiny handful, almost all of whom were also executed or killed in one way or another. No common sense appraisal of that would have ever said that anything would come of it. But it did, didn't it? And gradually, the whole world knows who Jesus is, and the Christian teaching have influenced just in ways that we can't even imagine. Swamiji often said to us, and he didn't say it with a point of pride, and he wanted to say it to us very carefully because he didn't want us to become confused by what he was saying. But he said, I think history will show that the most important thing happening in the world right now is Ananda and places like it, of which there aren't very many, but it is people who have decided that there's simply a completely other way of doing it. and are not choosing that alternative because there's been a government mandate or some kind of a blind study that says that this is true or that's true. It's just comes out of your inside. You know, when I became a vegetarian, when I became interested in self-realization, when I saw Swami Kriyananda, when I moved to Ananda, there was very little, I don't know, the word I want to use is rational component to it, but that doesn't actually mean it was irrational. It was just outside of the conscious mind putting the pieces together, evaluating and deciding. It was just the vibration of my soul. And what we're working with at all times, even though people don't realize it, we're not really working. Matter is just an illusion. Matter is just a vibration of energy. Everything begins with ideas, moves down through energy, and then finally manifests. By the time it's manifesting, we're at the last stage. It's the beginning that really counts. It's that vibration of energy. And Swami Kriyananda's life through this world, you know, having lived closely with him for as long as I did, and even when we didn't live on the same continent even, communication being what it is, I was always aware of what he was doing. He was just like this constant pulse of energy. And that energy would sometimes come out as music, sometimes it would come out as books, it would come out as lectures, it would come out through his meditation, it would come out through the projecting of thoughts into the ether that those who were in tune would just simply pick them up. He himself talked about his own style of leadership, he said. This was a very amusing cycle that took place. A number of years ago, Nishala wrote this very good book. I wish I could remember the name of it. Reflections on Community Living, I think it's called. And it was interviews with a lot of people who were founding members or early members of the Ananda movement. And she interviewed people, and then she wrote them up very well. She managed to clarify their thoughts, but keep their own voices. It's a very good book. And two people in that book, humorously, just because this is what we do, made reference to the fact that Swami Kriyananda had given them this giant assignment and then just said bye-bye and left them there to deal with it. Swami read the book, really liked the book, called up those two people and said, "I never left you alone." He said, "My consciousness was always with you." And then later he said, this is how he would lead. Because real change happens from inside. If we just get an idea from the outside and conform ourselves to it, well, that's probably better than having no ideals at all. But what we're really trying to do is we're trying to make ourselves into a new vibration. So we simply respond to life in a certain way. And Swamiji said he would project thoughts to us specifically, and then those ideas that we were in tune with, we would receive. And if we were deeply in tune with them, they would begin to become our own ideas. In the founding of this whole work here, which has taken place over the last 30-some years, and I've been privileged to be part of it since 1987, and when Swami Kriyananda dedicated our community in 1989, or 1990, whichever year it was, we bought it in 89, he dedicated it in 1990, I was aware of the fact that the whole movement of energy that brought that into manifestation, it was like riding a moving train. That would be the only way I could say about it. It was never a matter of sitting down and thinking, oh, what shall we do? Shall we, with the pros and cons of this idea, and you know, we should read books about how other people do it. I mean, none of that even occurred to us. It was just the ideas were always there. And there was always just this feeling of this is where we should go. This is before I'd heard Swami say what I just repeated to you. And I remember standing at that dedication, and we were on a dais. We'd put a stage up in the middle of the green in our community. And I remember standing there, and Swami was on the dais, and he was sitting just about there where that chair was, maybe a little closer. And I started talking about something, and suddenly, I mean, I felt so foolish for not ever having thought about it before. I was perfectly conscious that everything I was doing was coming right from there. And that I thought that I was being so clever, but I was just moving in a flow of grace that was being given to me. And the only part I had was that I showed up and I wanted to receive it. I wanted to receive it. And then I couldn't speak with my back to him. I had to move over and sort of talk like this because I just couldn't imagine having my back to the one who had put it forward. And Swamiji himself would just point to the masters and point upward to God. Whenever anybody touched his feet, he would always go like this, which was exactly what Master did. We have this idea because Master as the guru is presented as the beginning, you know, point of all this, but Master himself constantly deferred to Sri Yukteswar and to Babaji. And when people would speak of him as guru, he would say, God is the guru. You know, they're, all of us are just working as instruments of this great flow of energy. And the, when we wrap this around myself, I did this, any of these things, you know, all of this is just complete confusion. In the reading today, there's this wonderful sentence, which alone is enough for the rest of our lives. God, will you come to me? We have all these wonderful songs. Wilt thou come, just for once come to me? And we're always trying to sort of open the gates of our heart. But it isn't as if God is sitting there sort of refusing to cooperate, and we have to just keep piling fruit and vegetables at his feet or whatever it is that we're supposed to do. It's not that God has to come to us. This is how Swami puts it, is that we have to come to God. He's unchanging. He's eternal. The radiance of the divine light is beyond all time and space. Here it is, the eternal now. It's not more tomorrow than it is today, and it's not less yesterday than it will be a year from now. The very nature of it, it's infinitely, eternally unchanging, ever new but unchanging. I don't know, the words just, you just end up not knowing what you're talking about. I used to be much more confident about these things. Now I just go, like, really, who knows? But I can think about how I'm supposed to respond. And the reason we sing as if we're trying to draw God to us is that we're trying to awaken within us a longing for the right thing. Because we spend all our time wanting so much, so many different things all the time. You know, what is it that keeps us out of the present? We think about the past and we worry about the future. We long for what's gone behind, we regret what's gone behind, and then we hope for this. We hope that something will happen. Of course, when we finally get there, the problem is we take ourselves with this. You know, when you finally get there, there we are. You know, whenever I would take seclusions, have taken seclusion, I'm not very good at short seclusions, like 3 or 4 days, because it takes me longer than that to get rid of her. You know, she just hangs around for a few days, and so we don't enjoy ourselves as much as we do after she gives up and goes away. You know, if I'm not there long enough, I can't get that rhythm outside of myself. I had the incredible privilege over the last couple of years, because I was working on the book about Swami Kriyananda, I had weeks and weeks of seclusion, which was just heavenly. It's actually, truthfully, it's made it a little hard for me to accept another way of life, but I am gradually accepting it. Because then, when there's nothing else to want, then one discovers that one needs nothing else. Now, of course, I was writing, and therefore, and I was working, and I was very tuned into Swamiji. I don't think if I hadn't had a focus for my energy, I could have been as free. But even if you get that freedom, even for a split second, even for the tiniest moment, it begins to tell us, oh my, Look how much of my life I waste. We just waste it. Here's something interesting, and many of you have heard me talk about this book, which is now for sale in the boutique. Today's a big day. But besides that, this book has been on my mind to write since I was about 24, 25 years old. That's a lot of years. Let's just say that. It's a really, really, really long time. And it was a source, as I've explained to you, of tremendous anxiety to me. You know, this was the mother of all my fears, was that somehow I would die and not do this book. Finally, I got it to the point that I could die trying and that would be okay. But oddly enough, way back in the beginning, I always had this picture in my mind that if I did succeed, I would hold it in my hand on my 72nd birthday, which is 3 weeks from today, closely. Isn't that something? Now, I always knew that. Some part of me, even though it was just this weird sort of little projection in my head, but somehow some part of me knew it. So you have to stand back and say the obvious question, why do we ever worry about anything? Really, why do we spend so much time worrying about ourselves? When I was 19, 18 years old, actually almost 19, and Vivekananda's book, Raja Yoga and Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga, Jnana Yoga, it was a quartet, was handed to me. I don't really remember if I just opened it to this or if this is just what stays in my mind. There were three points that he said, which were the first in my way of thinking, the first three true things anybody ever said to me. He spoke of the law of karma and said, what you are today is a result of what you did yesterday, and tomorrow will be the result of what you're doing today. I mean, that was the key I'd been looking for. The second was actually from the Bible, but I didn't know that. Perfect love casts out fear. Ah, fear. Yes, that's my nemesis. That's the monkey that rides on my shoulder. And the answer to it is love. Wow, that was just fascinating to me. And the third thing, which was the whole point of why I brought this up. Oh, yes. Don't think about yourself and you'll be happy. Now, my first thought was, what else is there to think about? I mean, I wasn't selfish. I mean, I had a generous spirit from the time I was born, but I always knew where I stood in any situation. And I was always calculating my own advantage. Now, what I mean by that is my own advantage to me was to be happy and have fun. And fortunately, because my values were relatively uplifted, I had a relatively light consciousness. What was fun for me was generous and having a good time and helping people and so on like that. But I never, not for a moment, didn't know where I stood in relation to everything. And it was just really, literally incomprehensible to me. How can you not think about yourself? I just imagined that I would dematerialize and just turn into a heap of sawdust. And it just became fascinating to me and has fascinated me ever since how everything is fine until we decide to be upset. Because we're always breathing until we're not breathing, and then that's not a problem either. It's just all sort of goes away. But we're always asking, where do I fit and am I getting what I want? Are people treating me the way they should treat me? Are my expectations being fulfilled? Does my elbow hurt? Does my back hurt? Does my knee hurt? Am I as young and spry as I used to be? You know, I've gotten all these books now, and I can't even carry the darn things anymore. You know, I have to ask other people to carry them. I carry two at a time. You know, it's a very heavy book, but still I carry two at a time. You know, it's just like this is the way it is now. And all of that happens to us, and it just is what it is. I was listening to the stories from the other book I wrote about Swami Kriyananda as we have known him, which is, by the way, an extremely good book. I really recommend it. And I was listening to this story about Swamiji. I mean, I had written it and I was listening to myself read it, but I had forgotten it was me because it was such a good story. There were two incidences of Swamiji. Once he was in a public forum, it was like a meeting of the ways event, and all the teachers were sitting on the dais together and they were in rocking chairs. Somebody thought this would be fun. So different people were talking who were not that interesting to me, so I was watching Swami and he was rocking back and forth. But he didn't realize it, but as he rocked, his chair was gradually shifting, and just all of a sudden, he just fell off the edge of the dais. And I happened to be watching, but he did not exclaim, he didn't reach out, he didn't do anything. He just fell off. And almost no one noticed that he fell off, and then he just picked the chair up and put it back on and then started rocking again. On another occasion, it was at Ananda Village, and he was sitting on the little dais, which was only about a foot or 2 feet high, and somebody had put his chair very, very close to the edge, and he was speaking from a sitting position and made a big gesture like this, and the whole chair just topples over. And Swamiji just keeps talking. He just, you know, he just got up. He didn't even stop talking. And everybody else is going, oh, like this. And he's just talking like this. And I, now see, this is what I'm talking about. It's not just a question of disciplining ourselves. It's simply living in whatever is happening without this great anxiety about the past and this great anxiety about the future. I'm sitting up and now I'm toppling over. Now, all of us, most of us, would have a point of contrast in our mind. I used to be sitting up, now I'm toppling over. This is cause for great alarm. I used to be wealthy, now I'm poor. I used to be young, and now I'm old. I used to be married, and now I'm a widow. I used to have a child, and now I don't. Anxiety for the past, fear for the future. And it was a tiny thing, toppling over in a chair, but I watched him do it twice, and I watched him not respond. And it wasn't because he's iron and stoic. It's just, well, I'm sitting up, and now I'm falling down. I mean, it's extraordinary. You see, this is how it's really done. It's not done in this the dramatic way we think it's done. It's done moment by moment by moment by moment. This is what Master said, take care of the minutes, and the incarnations will take care of themselves. I had a very interesting moment of grace on this, and it was, believe me, this was just a possibility, not a reality, but in one of the pilgrimages I took to Israel, when I went in November with the Italian group, which was not quite a year ago now, we went to this place that was, it was where Jesus was taken when he was arrested, and it was said to be the house of Caiaphas, who was the high priest at the time. And there were a number of cells, of rooms, going down into the ground, one layer, two layer, three layers down into the ground, which were either storage rooms, but more likely they think that they were prison cells. And they think it likely that Jesus was put into some of those prison cells, because there was a whole night when he was arrested and he was taken here and there. So it's a fair supposition that that's what happened. Now, I have always had this is what I worry about. I remember from the past and worry about for the future, this fear of being imprisoned, this fear of being in concentration camps. I know that I've gotten myself in trouble politically in many incarnations, probably also religiously, and probably also just out of sheer cussedness a number of times. So being in prison is something that lurks in my mind. So we go into one of these downstairs places, and you know, it's a rock tomb. And it wasn't dark because it was illuminated, but it was silent, and it was way under there. I have intermittent claustrophobia, so I'm sitting in there wondering if I'm about to panic and have to run out. I had actually been in the cave in Nazareth where Jesus was born, and it was so crowded and so hot. Before I was able to relax and enjoy it, I had to run out because it was just too much. So here I am on the same journey. And all of a sudden, just by grace, I just went into the reality of what if, you know, what if I'm all alone and it's dark and I don't know if I'm ever coming out. And in that moment, I think Jesus whispered to me, it's all right, I'm here with you. Now, when is that not true? You know, we forget. Did we forget? But God doesn't forget us, we just forget him. So he's always, well, how do you say, closer than we are to our own selves. You know, lift up your eyes, the fields are white for the harvest. Even at the moment, we think it's 4 months till the harvest comes in. But God says, no, I am always with you. Are you with me? When Master passed, before Master died, Swami asked him, when you are gone, will you be as near to us as you are now? And Master said, to those who think me near, I will be near. But if you shut me out, how can I come in? God bless you.
Please save us a mountain. Light that will strike reconcile.